Good evening and welcome to the local news. Today is Monday, August 19th. I'm Lauren Schmidt, reporting for KMUD. In tonight's news, Humboldt supervisors target new threat to cannabis. Containment increases on the Boise fire in northeastern Humboldt. And after 27 years, the Independent prints final edition amid financial struggles. Stay tuned, news on those stories and more coming right up. After 27 years of covering politics, environmental news, the marijuana industry, and the arts, the Humboldt Independent, a family-owned newspaper, will be printing its final edition tomorrow, August 20th. Joe Kirby, the editor, shares more on what led to this decision and what the community can do to possibly prevent its closure.
The Independent was started up in the late 90s. By a group of folks, and I ended up becoming the editor a few years ago. It's a weekly newspaper. We've been a little bit on the ropes lately. We're having difficulty making enough money to pay our bills properly. That's kind of where we are.
Kirby explained that the Independent was initially created to fill the gap left by the closure of another local newspaper in our area.
There was a publication called the Redwood Record that went belly up around 1995. And so some of the people that used to work at the Redwood Record decided to pool their resources and start up a newspaper. That's how it got started. You know, it's had a few various owners and editors and stuff, but basically it started up, I believe it was in 1997. It's been going pretty much ever since then, until pretty recently.
The newspaper has been the only publication solely dedicated to serving Southern Humboldt, and tomorrow will likely mark its final day of printing news for the region.
That's true. That's the way it's looking at this point in time. Yeah, we're just not able to pay our bills properly.
Like other businesses in the community, the shifting economy of cannabis and the impacts of the pandemic have contributed to the newspaper's decision to close.
You know, legalization of marijuana has damaged the local economy. It took a few years for it to really soak in, but a lot of businesses have struggled because of just the economy's not good. You throw in COVID-19 coronavirus on top of that, that didn't help anything. A lot of businesses, you know, there's a lot of businesses that have gone out of business, shut down, and a lot of empty storefronts around Redway and Garville. And it's just kind of a sign of the overall economy, which has kind of trickled down to us as a newspaper.
As a free publication, The Independent relies on advertising to cover the costs of printing, office space, and paying its journalists, like Kelly Lincoln, Ray Oakes, and Daniel Mintz.
Well, that's another thing. We've got a shrinking cast. We used to have, you know, people that sold ads. We had people that built ads, graphic artists and stuff. And over the years, we've had to cut so many corners that, you know, basically it's just me and Ray and a few columnists and a couple of writers. That's about it. Yeah, I don't really quite know what to say, but it was 20 years ago, it was much more of a machine. Similar to the North Coast Journal, never quite at their level, but it was a bit more, a team effort, more people, more money, spread it around, get more product. And it's just gradually just gotten smaller and smaller. And yeah, it's just got a little bit unsustainable.
Kirby suggests that creating a membership roster might be a way to save the paper.
Well, we won't turn away any donations. You know, we're willing to work with people to try to figure out something.
However, with many people turning to social media and other internet sources for news, he fears that print journalism might be a thing of the past.
Part of it's just that, it's just kind of, I think people are almost kind of over it. I don't know any better way of putting it than that. We've had to cut down on our circulation because the papers just sit there in a pile, you know. Yeah, it's a bummer. I'm sorry it's gotten to this point, and I wish there was an easy way to turn it around. On the other hand, you know, it's been 25 plus years, and we've had a pretty good ride. Sure would like to thank everybody that's ever picked up an independent or supported us or said, hey, nice article. Much obliged, you know.
If members of the community are interested in supporting the independent in an effort to save the publication, they can contact Joe Kirby.
Well, he can reach us at the email address. It's in the paper. It's next to the question of the week on page usually 4. And it's a mouthful. It's editor@humboldtindy.com. Our phone number is 707-923-4205.
In his final thoughts, Kirby thanked Southern Humboldt for 27 years of support.
I do hope we've made it plain that we're very appreciative. We very much appreciate the community we're in and thankful for all the support over the years. Like I said, it's been a pretty good ride. And that's about all I got. We'll be around. Ray will be around. I'll be around. It's just kind of right now it's looking like maybe it's time for the next chapter.
The final edition of the Humboldt Independent will be available on Southern Humboldt shelves tomorrow, Tuesday, August 20th. KMA News will continue to share updates. A state bill that regulates psychoactive hemp is suspended, but it could be revived next year. And Humboldt County supervisors and cannabis farmers vigorously oppose it. KMUD's Daniel Mintz reports.
Humboldt County's Board of Supervisors is opposing hemp legislation that some believe will further destroy the local cannabis industry. Assembly Bill 2223 got a reaming at the August 13th supervisors meeting. It also got a snub from the state legislature 2 days after the meeting. A Senate committee declined to call a vote on it, which means the bill won't be taken up this year. Recommending approval of a letter opposing the bill, Planning Director John Ford said the state's goal of regulating manufacture and sales of hemp products is an important endeavor, but he said, quote, some of the ways that they're going about it cause a lot of concern. Synthetic high THC hemp is being sold in stores and at gas stations, hence the lawmaking effort, which originates from the governor's office. But Ford said the proposed regulations will give hemp a pass on the rules cannabis farmers must follow in California.
The struggle really has to do with placing hemp to be co-regulated with cannabis. And so high THC hemp can compete then with cannabis. And that's really what we're trying to address. So it's a fundamental issue of parity. Hemp doesn't have the same regulatory controls as cannabis does. Hemp is protected under the Federal Farm Bill and can be shipped across state lines and even can be shipped internationally. So this creates the potential for hemp products, even those grown out of the state, to be competing with cannabis products grown here in California and under California regulations.
Ford said the law should be changed to include a ban on adding hemp-based THC to cannabis products and to set a non-intoxicating THC level for hemp products. During a public comment period, Ross Gordon of the Humboldt Growers Alliance said unlike the expensive and time-consuming cannabis permitting process, hemp approvals are easily gained.
If you want to grow hemp anywhere in California where it's allowed, you pay a $900 registration fee to your county ag commissioner and you're done. You're just done. And so what is being proposed in parts of this bill is really to pull the rug out of all of the work that the county and the state has done to permit all of this cannabis cultivation, because the proposal is to allow this lightly regulated, essentially unregulated, hemp cultivation-derived THC to be sold in the same cannabis dispensaries as our cultivators. For all of the everything that our cannabis cultivators have gone through, the one thing that we still do have is that when you go through all of that and get your permit and your license, you're authorized to sell into a cannabis dispensary and nobody else is. So it's sort of all we have left for everything that's happened. And it's really the only thing that gives, for example, the environmental requirements in our ordinance any meaning at all.
Craig Johnson, co-owner of Alpenglow Farms, also described the bill as an affront to local cannabis farmers.
You know, there's a few things, I do a lot of public speaking, but there's a few things that get my hands sweaty. and, you know, my heart racing. And when the governor can just make one swoop of his pen and literally destroy everything we have built here is really, really concerning. So I'm very happy to know that the county is behind us, and thank you, Director Ford, and everyone involved with putting this together. We are definitely opposed, and let's amend it. But I also want to encourage all the supervisors, please make that extra phone call, take that extra minute. And as Ross Gordon said, this is going to be heard in 2 days. We need to send up the flags, the fireworks, everything to get their attention.
The bill was indeed taken up by the State Senate's Appropriations Committee on August 15th, and its chair didn't bring it up for a vote. The legislature adjourns at the end of this month, so the bill won't make that deadline, but it can be reintroduced for hearing next year. The letter was unanimously approved by supervisors. It cites the changes outlined by Ford as ones that will make the bill worthy of support. In Eureka for KMUD News, this is Daniel Mintz.
On Tuesday's Rio Del City Council agenda, it includes a proposed construction noise ban, the appointment of an interim police chief, and much more. KMUD's Sharon Wolf reports.
The city of Rio Del is proposing a construction activity noise ordinance that would restrict work throughout the city to specified hours. The upcoming city council meeting on Tuesday, August 20th, will include the second reading of a proposed ordinance which has been revised after the first reading on August 6th. The initial proposal would have banned anything perceived as construction activity which could make noise after 6 p.m. every weekday and entirely on the weekends. It didn't define what they meant by construction activity, so it could have included anything that made noise. The city had received complaints about underground digging work that was very loud and starting at 6 a.m., and since there is no restriction right now, they created this ordinance. After some public comment and feedback from council members, the proposal was amended, and that's what will be presented for approval. The revised ordinance on construction activity noise allows for work to be done from 7 a.m. to 8 p.m. 7 days a week. The new language says, quote, "No person shall, while engaged in construction, remodeling, digging, grading, demolition, painting, plastering, or any other related building activity, operate any tool, equipment, or machine in a manner which produces loud noises that could disturb, a person of normal sensitivity who works or resides in the vicinity," end quote. The definition of construction activity goes beyond that and includes, quote, "any physical activity," end quote, on the property. There is no exception for any unanticipated delays that might require work past that hard deadline of 8 p.m., and there are civil penalties involved. The ordinance applies to property owners and contractors alike. The city has an exemption from the ordinance for public works. The City Council will also hear the second reading of an ordinance on sewer lateral connections and required upgrades. Properties in Rio Del now require a sewer lateral inspection and needed corrections before they can be sold. The city has been built on haphazard infrastructure over the years, and that includes numerous shared sewer lines which are now banned. That's why the city created the inspection and correction requirements at the time of sale originally. Property owners must ensure that they have a clean-out and backflow device, as well as a double-sweep clean-out near the property line before anyone can buy it. And the city is hoping that that will bring all of the properties into compliance over time. Rio Del Police Corporal Crystal Landry will be appointed as interim police chief at the August 20th meeting. Interim chief Jeff Connor is leaving at the end of the month, and recruitment for a permanent chief is underway. Corporal Landry graduated from the College of the Redwoods Police Academy in 2018, and she began working for Rio Del shortly after, promoting to her current rank in 2021. Nitrous oxide sales could be banned in Rio Del as well as Eureka and other jurisdictions. The city of Eureka has contacted other cities about a ban after a fatal car accident in May where the driver was allegedly impaired from nitrous oxide use. Eureka has a draft ordinance that could be used to write a local measure if the council chooses. The agenda also includes doubling the deposit needed for renters to start water service from $100 currently to $200, and that deposit is refundable. The complete City Council agenda packet, which includes the supporting documentation, is available from the city and online at theriodeltimes.com. Video of the August 6th City Council meeting, which included the first reading of the proposed construction activity ban, is also available at theriodeltimes.com. The August 20th Riodel City Council meeting begins at 6 p.m. in City Hall and is streamed online at the Access Humboldt YouTube channel. This has been Sharon Wolf reporting for KMUD News.
Containment on the Boise Fire, located in the northeasternmost portion of Humboldt County, has increased, as well as the size of the fire. Adrian Freeman, Public Information Officer for the Boise Fire, reports that despite it expanding to 12,000 acres, conditions have improved.
We've had a couple really good days with high relative humidity, even some rain. I think the question is the fire out? No, unfortunately, it is not. But we are in a good place to be making good decisions. We have a lot of time on our hands to make sure we're building our containment lines and knowing that they'll hold, while also making sure that we're prepping structures, especially in the Salmon River corridor, just to make sure that should our primary lines not hold, we have a secondary and even a tertiary option.
This weekend's rain helped to cool the fire and slow its progression, but it also brought the risk of lightning.
Yes, yeah, so it's always a double-edged sword when you have convective activity, because, of course, you can get moisture. That helps us have time to build lines. It allows us to be more proactive instead of reactive as far as constructing our lines. However, that convective activity can come with those gusty outflow winds. Now, the thing about drainages like this is that there's often sort of a norm, right? It's something that we can predict. It's the diurnal winds. It's upslope up canyon in the afternoon, downslope down canyon at night. We call it the big suck. You know, those winds obviously affect fire behavior, but they're relatively predictable. When we get convective activity, what happens is all that predictability goes out the window. We're just kind of at the mercy of those outflow winds. That didn't materialize. So what we got was the benefit of the increased moisture, higher fuel moistures, higher air humidity, and did not see the negative effects of those outflow winds.
Containment has increased from 0% to 13% over the weekend.
Yeah, so that's the west side. It's the side closest to the community of Orleans. Now, that was our first priority when we got here because it was imminently threatened. So we went to work, especially on the ridge along Orleans Mountain by the lookout. We put some fire down quickly. We were able to meet it when we had that big growth with, I think the second or the third night. And we were able to hold that ridge. That's some pretty amazing firefighting that happened up there. But we had great crews and they were able to do it. Now we're looking at spread more to the east. So there's more impact on those Salmon River communities. That's Butler Flat, Forks of Salmon. And we are shifting our operations over there to prioritize the protection of those communities.
Crews have been assessing structures along the Salmon River and are putting sprinkler hoses and pumps in place to protect infrastructure should the fire overrun the primary line.
We are planning to stop the fire well west of the Salmon River. That being said, we always need to have contingency and even emergency lines. That's a community that's seen fire before. They are very fire savvy. They see the potential ecological benefits of fire coming in there, but we also have containment issues potentially with it crossing to the east side of the river. And so our goal and our direction to make is to make this fire just as small as possible. So we're looking at a line well west of the community. We are still prepping those structures and those residents just to make sure that we have that protection should it become necessary.
The Boise Fire has been considered a low priority for the Forest Service due to larger fires in the Northwest and Great Basin. However, just over 1,000 personnel are now assigned to the incident.
You know, we're seeing a few crews time out. We do have orders in for replacement in kind. You know, the terrain isn't going to change here. The need for those Type 1 hotshot crews isn't going to change here. We're working in very remote country, not a lot of road access. We actually have crews that are staying out on the fire line, and we are sling loading food and supplies into them. So we're doing everything we can to support those specific types of crews in the wilderness and in the backcountry areas. So really, that's the type of crew we need. We've managed to sustain so far. So hopefully into the future, we won't see any really big other starts or any of the lightning fires get big and see a pull on those resources. But we're not anticipating that right now.
The Boise Fire is a terrain-driven fire, heavily influenced by the region's mountains, valleys, and canyons. These features can cause the fire to spread rapidly or in unpredictable directions. For example, a fire can travel uphill faster than downhill, and winds channeled through narrow valleys can intensify flames. The terrain has also made firefighting difficult due to its remote location.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, one of the reasons we're keeping those crews spiked out there is so that they don't have to travel those, you know, single track roads on UTVs twice a day, getting in and getting out. You know, it mitigates both those safety concerns, but then also gives them more time on the fire line to work because they're not traveling for 2-3 hours a day to get to their job site, right? So certainly terrain is an issue. This is a terrain and fuels driven fire. There is more fire history in the area that we are in now, and that's giving us a little time combined with the moisture in the air, as I said, to be proactive about building those lines and making sure they're going to hold.
The fire showed little growth overnight, with conditions likely still moderated by wet weather. Today, crews stationed on Orleans Mountain Ridge will continue working to improve the line and establish containment to the north. Crews camped at Nordheimer Flat will focus on improving the line and setting up hose lays south from Echo Summit, while others work their way along High Point Ridge, opening and improving existing dozer lines. These efforts are expected to meet in the coming days, providing the primary containment line to the east.
We're not seeing any big predicted changes in weather. We're still expecting moderated temperatures, which is fabulous. I mean, even just from a human standard, it's much nicer to be working in the mid-70s than in the mid-90s, right? We are still seeing an inversion today over Orleans. My understanding is smoke conditions are pretty good in Forks, but it always seems to land somewhere. So I think we're going to see more of the same. When we start to worry is when we get these big changes in weather, in fuel dryness, that kind of thing. That isn't in the near-term future. So barring any unexpected things, and it's the weather, right? You know, it's unpredictable. I think we're looking at some pretty good days of work.
In conclusion, Freeman reminds the public that the forest remains closed in areas near the Boise Fire.
I know we're starting bow hunting season pretty quickly here. You know, really popular place for people to go in and do bow hunting and then later into rifle season. Just be sure you're being cognizant of those forest closures. It's not just about your safety and active fire behavior. A lot of it is trees standing dead. Also, fire equipment on the roadways. Roadways is a stretch, right? I mean, these are single track trails. So we want to keep the public safe, and we want to keep our firefighters safe. And so just asking people to respect those closures.
Evacuation orders and warnings remain in place for Humboldt residents southeast of Orleans. A full evacuation map and other critical fire information can be found on the Boise Fire Linktree. That's linktr.ee/2024 Boise Fire SRF. You can also find a link at kmud.org. In national news, the Environmental Working Group, a health and anti-pollution watchdog, released a new proposal for reducing the impact of forever chemicals in the United States in 2025 and beyond. KPFA's Scott Baba reports.
The new strategy proposed by the Environmental Working Group, or the EWG, to address the toxic forever chemicals known as PFAS would mobilize multiple government agencies not only to mitigate PFAS pollution, but also to safeguard public health and clean up PFAS-contaminated sites. John Reeder, the Environmental Working Group's Vice President of Federal Affairs, said that despite important strides to address the dangers of PFAS chemicals to the American public, significant work still remained.
The contamination crisis from the forever chemicals known as PFAS is far from over, despite the Biden-Harris administration's strides in implementing its government-wide plan to combat PFAS. In fact, EWG's map of PFAS in drinking water shows that over 130 million people receive drinking water contaminated with PFAS. The more EPA and the states look, the more they find.
PFAS chemicals are toxic at extremely low levels and are known as forever chemicals because they do not break down once released into the environment and can accumulate in the body. The Center for Disease Control and Prevention has detected PFAS in the blood of 99% of Americans, including newborns. Even very low doses of PFAS have been linked to immune system suppression, and studies show that exposure can increase the risk of cancer, harm fetal development, and reduce vaccine effectiveness. Scott Faber, EWG Senior Vice President of Government Affairs, said that there are a number of things the federal government can do to reduce the harm of PFAS, like
ending needless uses of PFAS, in particular by ending the use of PFAS in food packaging and food contact substances, by ending the use of PFAS in cosmetics, by ending the use of PFAS in pesticides and their containers, by ending the use of PFAS in fluorinated plastics, by ending the use of PFAS in fracking fluids. These are just some of the examples of the ways that the federal government can help end the needless use of PFAS in the things we bring into our homes and businesses or to make other things we use.
Among other things, the proposal suggests that the Department of Defense ensure safe drinking water for affected communities, end the use of PFAS in firefighting foam, and increase funding for cleanup efforts. It also calls on the Environmental Protection Agency to double funding for PFAS programs, enhance protection for air, water, and food, and enforce stricter controls on industrial discharges. Additionally, the Food and Drug Administration is urged to permanently ban PFAS in food packaging, set limits on PFAS in foods, and assess safer alternatives for drugs and medical devices. Melanie Benesch, EWG Vice President of Government Affairs, said that the government should set limits for the release of PFAS chemicals under the Federal Clean Air and Clean Water Acts.
We need to use those laws to address the PFAS problem where it starts, which is with the polluters. We also need to do much more to hold these polluters accountable for the harms that they have caused, including increased enforcement when polluters break the law, and also greater access to justice for the harms that they have caused for people in those communities that have been most greatly affected by the PFAS contamination crisis.
You can find the full proposal online at ewg.org. I'm Scott Baba, Pacifica Radio, KPFA.
That's all for tonight's broadcast. Thank you for listening. Thanks to our engineer, Javier Rodriguez. And thanks to our reporters, Daniel Mintz, Sharon Wolf, and Scott Baba. Reporting from our studio in Redway, I'm Lauren Schmidt.